So the next speaker is Sumit Sarbadikari, and he's going to talk about observational tests of momentum feedback by SNRs in M31.
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Sumit, and this session is called Supernova Remnants and Their Galaxies. And I thought we should have a conversation about how supernova remnants affect their galaxies. And so that's the title of my talk here. This is a work in collaboration with Davide Martizi, Enrico Ramirez Ruiz, Katie Alcatel, and Carlos Badenis. So first of all, what is feedback? Okay, when molecular clouds form stars, the potential energy of the molecular cloud turns into the binding energy of stars. And then when they become supernova, that energy or that momentum is transferred back into the ISM. And this return of that energy and momentum is called feedback. There are many types of feedback that you can get from stars. You can get photoionizing radiation, you can get H2 regions, you can get hot gas, but the feedback form that I'm going to focus on in this talk is supernova feedback. And this happens in the form of the objects that we've all been studying at this conference, which is supernova remnants. So I'm just going to give you a brief review of how that happens. So suppose you have an explosion, the supernova goes off, it's going to dump 10 to the 51 ergs of energy into the ISM, and this energy is going to propel a forward shock that's going to travel for several tens of thousands of years. And initially, the total energy, the total 10 to the 51 ergs, is going to be conserved. It's going to be 70% in the form of thermal energy, about 30% in the form of kinetic energy, but the total energy is going to be conserved, and we call this the set of Taylor stage or the adiabatic phase. Now, the remnant is also cooling at the same time, okay? The energy so far has been conserved because the energy lost by cooling has been minimal. But when cooling becomes significant, when you've lost quite a bit of energy, then the material right behind the shock, it cools and forms this dense cold shell. And I'm going to call this radius the cooling radius. And I'm going to refer to this quite a lot in the subsequent part of the talk. And so while there's a cold shell outside, the interior of the remnant is by the reverse shock. And so it's a very hot gas inside. And so for a brief period of time, the pressure of this hot gas propels the supernova remnant forward. But eventually, the pressure inside and outside equalizes. And so by Newton's second law, you basically have this expanding shell of momentum-conserving gas. And so this is momentum feedback. This shell of gas ultimately, or this momentum ultimately, dissolves in the ISM, and that produces turbulence or these turbulent motion. So as a result, supernova feedback is actually responsible for many important processes in the galaxy. If you take into account that one supernova happens every few decades, they can launch winds, they can produce turbulence, which supports the ISM against gravitational condensation. They can launch cosmic rays, which can also produce winds and turbulence. And through a combination of these processes, supernova feedback can regulate the global star formation rate of galaxies. And so people that study galaxy simulations or galaxy formation need supernova feedback. Okay, this is the Millennium simulation. It was a huge cosmological simulation of galaxies. Without supernova feedback, the entire gas in the simulation would have turned into stars. The universe would have been full of star clusters. There would have been no galaxies. So supernova feedback is a very important part of these simulations, but there's a fundamental change, which is that these simulations, just like every other simulation, grid. And I'm showing a regular grid size here, but the grid size will depend on the local density. But just that the smallest size of these grids are much, much larger than the scales on which supernova remnants evolve. They're much larger than the cooling radius of remnants, much larger than the mass swept up by remnants. And so, in other words, you cannot self-consistently produce a remnant in these large cosmological simulations. And that's a big problem, because then numerical modelers have to do the one thing that they hate, which is parameterize. And so that leads to subgrid models of feedback. Okay, so subgrid models basically means models, or maybe a numerical recipe or an analytical recipe of the feedback that is originating at the scales below these resolution limit. Now, there has been many different types of subgrid models that have been developed in the literature, and that'll be the subject of an entire talk or maybe a conference even. So I'm just going to direct you to this annual review by Thorsten Nobben and Ostriker. But basically, there are various types of subgrid models that try to suppress the star formation rate and not necessarily try to realistically evolve a supernova remnant. So you have delayed cooling, stochastic cooling, wind feedback. These are various ways in which you can suppress supernova remnant. And these are not always physically accurate or physical. Okay, so for example, delayed cooling basically dumps thermal energy into the gas and shuts off cooling for some X amount of time such that, you know, not all the gas turns into stars. And so the problem with this is that this prolongs the set of Taylor stage of supernova remnants way beyond what we actually see. But another issue is that these subgrid models are generally tuned to the stellar mass function of galaxies or the properties of galaxies. So you're kind of in this weird regime where you're tuning your model to the properties of galaxies and then making predictions about the properties of galaxies. So there's a lot of debate about what's an acceptable subgrid model. And so part of the community, especially my collaborator, Davide Martisi, has been trying to develop these subgrid models from high-resolution simulations of set-of-stage supernova remnants. And this is one example of a simulation run, and you can see that the ISM is initialized as an inhomogeneous medium. And that's important because momentum deposition in supernova remnants has been known for a while. It's been known since the 80s and 90s. But one uncertainty was how much momentum changes, how much the momentum changes if the ISM is inhomogeneous. And what you can see is that this is the homogeneous run. The momentum increases at the set of Taylor stage, but then it reaches a constant value after the cooling radius has been reached. In the inhomogeneous medium, the momentum is suppressed by about, but it drives momentum on a much larger scale. And so this is actually great because you can use momentum feedback in cosmological simulations, because these simulations cannot resolve the scale of supernova remnants, all right? So they're generally larger, but the momentum stays constant, so you can just use that value. And so what he did was that he turned these into analytical relations, and what he checked was, you know, is this consistent with the ISM turbulence that you generate in simulations? So the black points here, the black line here, is the turbulent ISM simulation that I showed earlier. And the red is the subgrid model that you would generally use in a cosmological simulation. And you can see that roughly at steady state, they agree with each other. So these momentum feedback models from these high-resolution simulations are clearly an exciting prospect. Now, the question that I'm asking, and this is where I kind of come in, is that can we trust these simulations, okay, before we throw them into a cosmological simulation and then tune them to the stellar mass function and then enter that vicious circle of, you know, trying to predict what you're tuning to. So there are observations of the ISM in our local group, and the signature of turbulence is basically broadened line widths of, let's say, H1, the 21-centimeter H1 line. And so we're trying to compare this model to reproduce the H1 that we see in our local universe. And so to do that, we do this one quick step, which is you see that the turbulence reaches a steady state after some time in these simulations, and you can approximate that with an analytical relationship if you assume that the rate at which the turbulence is decaying is equal to the rate at which supernova is injecting momentum. And if you do that, then your velocity dispersion, or the width of the line, can be approximated by this relation, which is depends on the final momentum that is deposited by remnants, the density of the medium, and the supernova rate. And so we have a ton of observations in our local group galaxies, and we're going to try to see if we can constrain these models. So I'm setting this up. So the final momentum, as I said, comes from the simulations that I just showed. The density comes from H1 maps that has been taken in M31. This is a survey by Robert Braun in 2009. And the supernova rate, and this is the part that I wish I had a little more time to talk about, this comes from the FAT survey, which has mapped out the stellar population in the northern one-third half of M31 down to almost a solar mass. And so there's like 117 million catalog of stars. And we know exactly where the old stars and young stars and how many of them are in this region of the galaxy. And so if we combine that with the supernova delay time distribution, which is basically the repository of all the knowledge that we have about supernova progenitors, which is core collapse or type 1As or whatever it is, if we combine these two information, we get a very solid handle on what the supernova rate should be in all these regions. And so we have the density from these maps, supernova rate from these FAT survey, and then basically the one thing that we're kind of varying in our model is, or not varying in our model, but the contentious part of our model is the final momentum. And finally, you can also compare the predicted velocity dispersion with the observed dispersion that you see from these radio data cubes from where we got the H1 density. And one final point is that we are going to restrict the analysis to the star-forming ring of M31, because there are various ways in which you can broaden lines. You know, you can have a rotation of galaxies, you can have magnetic instabilities, you can have UV heating, but in the star-forming ring, the dominant form of stellar feedback. So at least there's no ambiguity in this ring. So this is the result, and what I'm showing here is the ratio of the predicted to the observed velocity dispersion, the supernova rate on the x-axis, and color-coded by column density. And so you can see that most of the points are over-predicted by our models. Now, the error bars represent the fact that you're looking at these density maps in projection, so supernova can go off anywhere within that line of sight. And so that takes into account the uncertainty due to the density along line of sight. And we also assume a certain scale height of that density distribution, and it's set to 400 parsecs based on observations by Robert Braun. But for a second, let's just assume that that's wrong, and I decrease the scale height by a factor of 4. That brings down some of the points, but you still have a lot of pixels, a lot of regions of M31 where the model overpredicts the observations, and then a lot of these low density, the dark points, are overpredicted compared to this dashed line. And so what does this mean? So what really we think is happening here is that these models are essentially one-dimensional models. And they're not taking into account a lot of higher dimensional effects that is taking place. So at high supernova rates, for example, what could be happening is that you could have two supernova going off within maybe a few cooling radii of each other, and they collide, and the shocks kind of cancel the total outgoing radial momentum. And that could suppress the radial momentum by a few factors. At low densities, what could be happening is remnants merge with the ISM before they actually even start cooling. So they never really end up depositing much momentum and therefore much turbulence. And so that's basically the summary of my takeaway, simple, which is that, you know, the supernova remnant community, we're a small community, but the understanding that we've gathered about supernova remnants is extremely valuable to the larger community of people that are studying galaxies and how structure forms in our universe. And I've showed that, you know, if you compare these subgrid models, which are generally attached to cosmological simulations, and if you test these with our galaxy or our local group galaxy observations, you can correct for a lot of these second order effects or higher dimensional effects that is basically impossible to do in cosmological simulations themselves. So they can really anchor our understanding of structure formation in the universe. So with that, I'm going to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Sumit. Questions? Yeah, over there.
Very nice. When you look at the cosmological simulations and the star formation simulations, for instance, the transition from population 3, i.e. metal 3, to population 1 and 2 metal rich. What you see, I mean, if you play with all the parameters that you mentioned, one is the momentum feedback from the supernova and the yield, that influences the star formation, however, and the metallicity threshold and the density threshold and the IMF and everything. Interestingly, the many parameters become insensitive. So the ratio of the population 3 star formation to the population 1 and 2 becomes pretty much constant. Like, for instance, you go down to 10 to the minus 3 by redshift 6, and you get more substantial than 10. So I'm just wondering, you have to be careful not to look at only one parameter, but all.
There's no POP3, POP2 stars involved here because I'm only simulating ISM.
Yeah, one and two even, but doesn't matter. It only depends on the dominant cooling, whether it's molecular or metal, even for POP2.
Okay. Sure, but the momentum deposited has a very weak dependence on metallicity. It only varies as metallicity to the like 0.13. So unless the metallicity in the spiral arm is drastically different by like two decks or something, these points should not vary too much. And I'm only simulating the local, the observations that you see today. So yeah, in the simulations that I showed earlier, cosmological simulations, you have POP2 to POP1 transitions, but I'm not quite there yet. I'm just doing the observations in the M31 disk, like today.
Yeah. All right, yeah.
This is great. Yeah, I thought that in these in simulations of this kind of things and feedback and so on, that you had to take into account the fact that you had multiple supernovae exploding really in the same region because most of your star high mass star formation was in clusters. You didn't explain there, it wasn't clear to me how you're dealing with that.
So in M31, the supernova rate in these cells is quite low. It's about one supernova every like 100,000 years, which is kind of the order of one cooling age. So in order to have a supernova boost from correlated supernova, you need to have two supernova going off within a cooling radius and a cooling time of each other. Otherwise, you know, it's basically equivalent to resetting your simulation back to the initial supernova. So in M31, the supernova rate is low, and so I think that that effect is not as pronounced, but if you go to M83 or something, or a more high star forming galaxy, that would become important.
There was a question right
there,
behind.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a question about applying this to our galaxy. Have you tried to look to apply this model to the possible inhibition of star formation in our galaxy? Because actually Andy Burger and myself did some feedback on supernova, especially including also type 1a on dwarf galaxy. And we noticed that there was a factor of totally preventing star formation for 10 to the 9 years in dwarf galaxies if we followed type 1a supernova, including also type 2s in those ones. So we wanted to do also something for our own galaxy, though the effect is going to be smaller. But there is, it has been seen that in our galaxy, the star formation decreases at a given point, 10 to the 9 years it decreases, but there is a kind of bump up, going up to more star formation after 10 to 9 years. And this may be related perhaps to inhibition by type 1a feedback, you know?
Well, I also include type 1a feedback in these things. So the supernova delay time distribution is for core collapse and 1as as well. But in this particular ring right here, most of the dominant form of feedback is from type 2s. But elsewhere in the galaxy, like in the outskirts, you're right, type 1as might actually dominate. And in fact, one of the things that I checked was that in the bulge of the galaxy, it's mostly old populations, there's no young star formation. The type 1a feedback here is huge. And we also see that there's a lot of diffuse iron emission here. So that could also be that, you know, gas was launched from type 1a ejecta into the halo. And so these sorts of regions, we think type 1as could be important. But I haven't looked at it in our galaxy.
So, but in this galaxy, you see also this kind of profile going down and also upwards?
It's peaked in the center. It kind of.
No, I mean.
Are you speaking about type 1a?
No, the star formation. I'm talking.
Star formation. So I think the star formation radially decreases. But if you're asking about type 1a, it has a more like bumpy distribution.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We can chat about this. That sounds interesting.
Sorry, we have to move on. So thank you again, Sumit.